what it's about. There's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
All right, welcome to a Tuesday afternoon. And I keep forgetting to do this. You know, it's a whole new world here, and I forget to mute the other computer. All right, we got it going now. As I was saying, it is a Tuesday afternoon here on the, well, all over the place. Well, in the U.S. anyway. I know we've got people from all over listening, which is a really, really cool thing. I am Nicole Sandler. It is radioornot.com, and we do a little bit of everything here. Yeah, you know what? One of the nice things about moving not only to the internet, but to my own. Yeah, Sue Ann is in one of the chat rooms, and I know she's across the pond, as they say, and it is a Tuesday evening there. Thank you, Sue. Yeah, it's, I guess we could talk to Sue and find out what's going to happen tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow night, maybe tomorrow at this time, she'll join us during the show and tell us what the president said during the State of the Union. Okay, I know it doesn't work that way. It is whatever time it is, wherever you are. And I know a lot of people are going to be listening on the podcast too. So we'll just say, if you are watching and listening live, it is, I got to turn this down a little bit too. It is Tuesday afternoon here in Miami, which is where I'm doing the show from. Just dropped the kid off for karate lessons. I hear that's very good for children who are, who have ADHD. Hopefully it'll help her focus a little bit. Join in the chat. As I said, we are doing the video stream on Ustream. The link is on the brand new radioornot.com website. And again, thanks to the amazing work of Heather Chase, who just did such an incredible job putting the new site together. And we're still working on things and tweaking things and working on getting the audio streaming going. But again, you know, this all happened so quickly. We got the word on Thursday afternoon when you did, actually, after some of you did, because listener Betsy is the one who informed me via the Facebook chat that Air America was closing down. She saw it before I did, and she let me know. And, it's called scrambling. But, hey, we got this far so far. All right, we do have a good show for you tonight. In hour two, one of my regular guests, one of my favorite guests, Howie Klein, who writes the blog at downwithtyranny.com and is probably the most knowledgeable person I know about congressional races going on all over the country. And if the past week was any indication, we need to work extra hard to make sure we get progressives elected to Congress, that we need to get rid of the blue dogs along with the Republicans and get as many true progressives there, okay, elected. And I see I'm for Earth in the Ustream chat room says she's got to take off in about an hour because she's got a meeting. Everything will be podcast. All right, you can subscribe to the podcast. If you go to iTunes, just search for Radio or Not or Nicole Sandler. It should come up. Or just go to radioornot.com. You can listen directly from the website. Hopefully within an hour or so after the show ends. I will also post the video on the video page. Again, we've got a lot of stuff going on. And as we get more into the program, hopefully it'll become more automated where things will just happen. But right now it's a lot of work that goes into it. But we're getting there. So Howie Klein will be with us in the next hour. Later on this hour, if we have time, I'm going to play for you an interview I did earlier today. I spoke with Adam Cohen, who wrote this book, Nothing to Fear. It's about FDR's inner circle and the 100 days that created modern America. It is a fascinating read. I mean, even with everything that's going on with me, I've been stealing moments away to read this book because it's really good. And I was never a real history buff. But if there's one president I want to learn a lot more about, it is FDR. Because that's what we need in Obama, you know? I should have gotten him on the phone earlier. So we're going to just try to call right now. We all know of the problems, what's going on in Haiti, right? And one of the saddest stories about what's happening in Haiti is the fact that there are so many children there who are being left, left parentless. Now, I know a lot of people who adopted from Haiti before the earthquake struck, but I know a lot of people are coming forward wanting. Hey, Rob, it's Nicole. We're live on the air. Hold, I'm
Hello.
Doing a little intro. So here, what I'm telling the listeners is that before the earthquake struck, a lot of people did adopt kids from Haiti. Haiti is such a poverty-stricken country, and there were a lot of people who would just give their kids up because they simply couldn't afford to feed them. That plus, there were just orphans as well, so children were available. A few months ago, back in November, I did a special adoption program talking about, just adoption. November is National Adoption Month. And people who listen to the show regularly know that that I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan. And every November, especially every November, I try to do at least one show on adoption because I figure if I can help one more child find a forever home, I'll talk nonstop about our adoption. So this past November, what I did is I got a group of people together, a group of people who went through their adoptions all together at the same time I was going through mine. And this was, we started the process in 2000, mid-1999, actually. And we all found each other. There are all these listservs especially for international adoption. And we found each other on this listserv and realized we were all using the same agency. So we contacted each other off list and we started our own little mini mailing list. That was almost 10 years ago that we found each other. And we are still a very tightly knit group. Even though some of us have only met once or twice, some of us have never met. We are, we're all there for each other. And we went through this together. In fact, we're planning a get together this summer because it's, for many of us, it's going to be our 10 year anniversary of bringing our children home. So in November, I had a handful of the people in my adoption group on the show. There's another woman who I was hoping to hear from tonight, and I'll check email to see if she's home and got my messages. But after she adopted her daughter from Russia, she then a year or two later, went to Haiti and adopted a little girl from Haiti. So she's got a Russian child and a Haitian child. And I wanted to shine the spotlight on the plight of these children and what they're going through. Joining us on the line right now is Rob LaMarche. Rob is the, are you the director of the Florida Office of Alliance for Children?
You got it.
Okay. And Alliance for Children, their website is allforchildren.org, all spelled out, allforchildren.org. And they are an adoption agency based, you tell us, Rob. Tell us about Alliance for Children, first of all.
Thank you, Nicole. Well, as you have already said, the Alliance for Children is a private, nonprofit, primarily international adoption agency. Our main office is in Wellesley, Massachusetts. I have an office here in Fort Lauderdale. And provide, adoption services, home studies for families all around the state of Florida. We do not currently have a program in Haiti. We have previously, I wanted to avail myself to this conversation because as a joint council member, I do keep myself posted on what is happening in Haiti in terms of the adoption process, and I have a very good friend and colleague, Diana Bonney at Kentucky Adoption Services, who does have a program, an adoption program in Haiti.
Now, so tell us what the situation is now. I mean, I know that we have had, there are reports of just so many kids being orphaned. But when the fact is, though, families right now are in such flux. They're all separated, and nobody knows who's really orphans and who aren't. That's the newly orphaned children. But then there's another whole situation that's also going on of kids who were approved for adoption before the earthquake hit, and a lot of those adoptions are being held up now, too.
Right. Well, over the last week or so, people may have heard news stories about children from Haiti being flown to the United States, and in some cases to countries in Europe. And the fact of the matter is I'm going to say it's probably in the hundreds, though I don't know the exact number, of children have been able to leave the orphanages in Haiti. But those are children who've already been adopted by U.S. families. These are children whose families have met them, in many cases, more than one occasion, have been in process for a number of years, have officially adopted these children, have been waiting for the visa process to be resolved so those children can come home. The United States, USCIS, and the Department of State, and you know, other organizations were working to expedite the visa process for those children. So while I've been getting a lot of calls about, you know, oh, we hear there's all these children that are in need and all these kids are coming home, those kids are in a very different set of circumstances than the children who are, you know, are still in Haiti. The plan has been to unite children who are already adopted. The second wave is a hope to unite children with their families that have been matched, even if the adoption hasn't quite yet finalized under something called a humanitarian parole. And that's where the focus is now. I'm really excited that so many people have been calling saying they're interested in adopting children from Haiti, but the infrastructure just doesn't exist now.
Uh-oh, did I lose you? Rob? Rob? Uh-oh. I think we lost Rob LaMarche. All right, we'll hang up and we'll try to make recontact. Let's try this again. The wonders of not having a producer and doing it live. What he was saying was, let's see. Here we go.
Hello, you've reached Rob LaMarche.
Okay, we'll try back again in a second. Yeah, what the problem is that I think what Rob was getting at is the infrastructure does not exist now for adoptions because, first of all their records are gutted. That's number one. Number two is, you know, they can't. They can't.
Hello?
Hi, Rob. Sorry, we I guess lost the call there. So you were saying.
I don't know.
Yeah, you were saying that the infrastructure in Haiti, it doesn't exist right now to even start the adoption process. Is that where you were?
Absolutely. So in the best of times, the adoption process in Haiti is quite difficult and not terribly efficient. Given the complete collapse of the infrastructure there now, it's going to be some time before there are any new adoptions initiated. The focus, as I said, presently is getting the children who have been adopted out of Haiti, but also making sure that the children who are on the streets have, you know, a safe place to live. So as children are leaving the orphanages, going to their adoptive families, more children are coming into the orphanages, and an effort is being made to identify any living relatives that may be in a position to care for these kids, and that is, you know, that is what needs to be done before any of those kids could be considered available for adoption.
That's right, because they'd much rather have the children with some family there than uproot them and, you know, take them to a strange country or anything. But, you know, there was the news story that dominated at least down here for a couple of days of Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania flying down and helping to bring back 53 children. Were all those children already placed?
Yes, they were.
Wow.
I actually know the circumstances of those children very well. and they were united with their adoptive families in Pennsylvania.
Wow. Now, I know down here, I got an email from one of the Teamsters local in North Miami saying that the Miami Archdiocese, I believe, was taking care of some Haitian orphans, and they were asking for donations for kids from, you know, infants to 6 years old. And Allison and I went through her closet, and we cleaned out a whole big garbage bag full of stuffed animals that we brought down there. And the people were just ecstatic and said, oh, this is going to make the kids so happy. So what kids are in Miami?
Well, I don't know the circumstances of all the kids, obviously, that have come into the United States so far. My understanding about a group of kids that were supposed to arrive in Miami, I think last Thursday or Friday, was that those two were children who had already been adopted, and that they were just needing a temporary place until their families could all get to South Florida. Again, I can't be quoted on that because I don't know that for fact, but that is what I gathered from, you know, the various websites and people that I've talked to. They're not, you know, kids are not just being brought to the United States who have not been adopted by families. That's just not what the United States government is interested in doing. It's not what the Haitian government is interested in doing. So there are families that are receiving these children when they're coming here into the United States.
I see. So, but for now, I mean, a lot of well-meaning families are. I vaguely remember when I was a kid, right when the Vietnam War was ending, we were pulling out. My parents, my mother was talking about wanting to adopt, you know, a child from Vietnam, because I guess there were a lot of war orphans. It never happened. But I know that now a lot of very well-meaning people are watching these pictures on TV and saying, I want to go and bring a child home. I mean, they want to open their hearts and their homes, but you're saying it's going to be a while before any of that is even possible now, right?
That is true. I wouldn't discourage people from making their interests known. I think they just need to give the agencies that are working in Haiti a little bit of time. Anybody that I've talked to that has a program in Haiti is right now worried about feeding their children that are still there and not even in a position to take names and numbers of folks who might be interested in adopting down the road.
Right. And Rob, not only feeding them, but putting a roof over their heads, because I mean, I saw stories, the buildings all collapsed and they're living outside for fear of yet another aftershock, even if they are in a building that's still partially standing. So feeding them, clothing them, housing them. And
absolutely.
So right now, I mean, they do need help. And so if you go online, say, and do a search of Haiti adoption, I would guess you'll be able to find some agencies that work there that maybe could use some help financially or with donations in kind.
Yes, you can do that. You can also go to the Joint Council website, which is the Joint Council on International Children's Services, which is jcics.org. And that is our member agency for international adoption agencies. And they are keeping a really good updated site in terms of what is happening around the relief effort and around the issues related to, you know, the orphans in Haiti. You know, your point is well taken in terms of housing them. I had mentioned earlier my friend Diana, who runs a program there, and yesterday she was telling me that this one particular house that they have for children that typically holds 70 children, Bresma 1 is the name of the house, structurally is unsound. So 48 children and their caretakers are camping out in the, you know, basically on the lawn until they can get an engineer or somebody to come in and tell them that the building is safe, which, as you can imagine, is going to be some time because it's just, you know, the entire, you know, there's so much devastation. So, I mean, people, I hope that these people who are calling agencies and looking for, you know, opportunities to adopt will understand that there is a tremendous need for just assistance. These kids can't be adopted right now, but they need to be taken care of. And as time passes, there will be more orphans available because the process will be put in place and there will be children who will need homes. They may not all be 1 and 2 years old. They're going to be 3, 4, 5, 8, 10-year-olds who
right.
need homes.
Sure.
But it's just really important that people recognize that this crisis in Haiti is going to be with us a very, very long time, and these children will need support for the foreseeable future.
Yes, yes, they will. Robert LaMarche is with us. He's the director of the South Florida office of Alliance for Children. It's an international adoption agency, though you do some domestic work and you do home studies as well. When you adopt internationally or domestically, you need to go through a whole long process. One of those is the home study, and you need a domestic agency to do that. Their website is allforchildren.org, allforchildren.org. And you work all over the country, not only in the cities in which you have an office, right?
Absolutely. We have social workers all over the United States. We have offices in Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, South Carolina, and Florida. But we're able to work in any state in the United States.
And what countries do you currently have programs in?
We have programs in Russia, Kazakhstan, China, Ethiopia, Colombia, and our domestic program, here in the United States.
You know, when I talk about adoption, and you know very well that I'm a big proponent of adoption. In fact, I met Rob a few years ago when I was doing the morning show here in Miami at WINZ, and Rob sent me an email and said, hey, November's National Adoption Month. How about doing an interview about it? And I said, I'm so glad you wrote, because it was coming up on November and I wanted to do something. Again, because I had adopted my daughter a few years earlier from Kazakhstan, did not go through Alliance for Children, and I didn't even know Rob back then. But one question that comes up a lot is people ask me, well, why did you go all the way to Kazakhstan? There are so many kids here in the U.S. who need a family, who need a home. And in my case, at the time I was a 40-year-old woman, single, and I thought at the time I wanted an infant. Well, she was 18 months old when I adopted her, but the process is difficult. So there was that, especially for a single woman. And also, honestly, I was a little afraid. I didn't want somebody coming banging on my door one day saying, I want my kid back.
Right.
Those were all fears of mine, and plus my heritage is Russian, and I just immediately went for Russian adoption. Turned out my daughter happened to be in Kazakhstan. You sort of go where the process takes you. But what is your answer to that question? Why go somewhere to another country? Why not adopt a child who needs a home here?
Well, I think it's important to first point out that more children are adopted domestically in the United States than are adopted from other countries into the United States. So a tremendous number of people do adopt domestically. But it's not the right fit, and it's not the right program for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There are folks who are not interested in becoming foster parents and
right.
running the risk of having a child that they've grown attached to and fallen in love with leave their care and be reunited with a birth parent. And many times working through a state system, it requires that you have that level of flexibility. Some people just know they can't, they're not able to do that, so they won't pursue that option. Other people are looking to adopt babies.
Mm-hmm.
They want a real little person. And many of the kids that are available through the state child welfare system are school-aged children and
right.
older.
Yep.
And no less deserving and no less wonderful kids. But for many families, the idea of parenting a little one is what comes to mind.
Right.
Certainly, single folks sometimes have some difficulties adopting domestically from private agencies, because in situations where birth mothers select, oftentimes they'll choose a traditional couple over a single person who might be looking to adopt. Whereas in the countries that will accept single-parent applicants, basically you're on the same list that everybody else is on. So, as the person in front of you is placed with a child, you move up on the list. And it's not sort of left to fate whether you're chosen or not, because you've already been approved, you've been accepted into the program. And from a legal risk standpoint, when you're looking at domestic adoption, particularly private adoption, one of the risks there is that birth mothers have an opportunity to change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of families can't tolerate the notion of that risk, the thought of, you know, being involved with the birth mother for, you know, her last trimester, maybe being at the hospital, maybe meeting that baby, and 48 hours later finding out that, in fact, she's not going to go through with the adoption
right.
process.
Right.
That's not what mostly happens, but it happens enough that people are afraid. So when folks decide to do an international adoption, what they're doing is they're minimizing that risk. Typically, you don't even know about a child internationally unless they're already legally freed. But those families, you know, you and I have discussed this before, those families are trading risks. You know, in the United States, you're going to get a lot of good, typically, developmental information, maybe a psychosocial on the mom, you know, the benefit of a child being born in the U.S. and having prenatal care. Or if you're adopting a child maybe from Russia or Colombia or Ethiopia, you're never going to get the level of information, background information that you'd like. Chances are the child didn't have, you know, mom didn't have prenatal care. If you're talking about a child in a Russian orphanage who's 3 years old, well, what are the effects of institutionalization on children? So, you know, it's a deeply personal decision that families have to make about what are the risks that my family can tolerate. And that's what leads some people down the domestic road, and it's what leads other people down the international adoption road.
Right, and that's also one of the reasons why you want to go with a good agency who's going to really, you know, fill you in on all the different options and tell you what the
right.
risks are and what the problems
right.
are and what the benefits are. Bottom line is whether, you know, it's a child who's an orphan in an orphanage in Kazakhstan or, you know, in foster care here in the U.S., they're both children who need a family, who want to be loved, who want a, you know, a mother and or a father or some combination of the two.
Right.
You know, in my case with Allison, you know, in many times, as you said, it's a giant leap of faith. She was a foundling. You know, a lot of the attitudes in some of these countries are now what they were here in like the 40s and 50s. You know, people didn't talk about adoption. You know, it was like, and a lot of times kids weren't even told they were adopted until they were adults in many cases. The days of where someone would be left, a baby would be left on a doorstep because the mother didn't know what to do with her. Well, that's what happened with Allison. She was left on a doorstep of a private home in Kazakhstan with the translation reads something like in a household sack with a cap, two diapers, a blanket, and a bottle of formula. And they estimated that she was about a month old, that she looked premature and seemed to be about a month old. So, I mean, the story that I came up with, obviously, is that her birth mother loved her, realized she couldn't take care of her, and placed her in front of a nice home, hoping that the people would take her in. They called the police, who brought her to the hospital. They checked her out, and then she was taken to the orphanage. And she was in an orphanage for 18 months. And, you know, then the medical reports you get are very sketchy. They're in another language. You have to get them translated. It's a lot of stuff. And, you know, there were some concerns. But, you know, I once I decided she was my daughter, my attitude was, whatever it is, I'll deal with. And that's sort of the leap of faith you take.
Right. I agree. Absolutely.
Now, Alliance for Children works in Kazakhstan. One of these days, I mean, Allison is still only 10, but when she gets older, maybe when she's 16 or so, you know, I want to take her back there and to see the orphanage and maybe do a humanitarian trip and bring some supplies and things like that. Do you arrange for those kind of things with maybe some of your clients that have adopted from countries?
Homeland tours, that's what they're called, mm-hmm. have become very, very popular. Most of those tours have emerged out of organizations like FCC, which is Families with Children from China.
Right.
Organizations like the group that you are affiliated with, you know, all the folks that adopted around the same time that you adopted Allison.
Mm-hmm.
It's really been private people who have established these homeland tours. I'm not saying no agencies are doing them, but I have to tell you, as a you know a small nonprofit, bringing you know 150, 175 children home a year is about all we can handle right now.
Sure.
So the thought of trying to make those kind of arrangements,
right.
I don't even know what that would look like. But between the adoption process and our foundation, which the Alliance for Children Foundation is an entity that exists solely to support the kids who are left behind, the children who can't be adopted for whatever reason.
Mm.
We're pretty much running at full capacity. But for you, Nicole, I'd see what I could do.
Okay. Well, we're still a good 6 years away from that. So we've got some time. Robert LaMarche is the director of the South Florida office of Alliance for Children. Their website is allforchildren.org. And, you know, one other thing is a lot of the people who I adopted with, most of them wound up, yes, adopting from Russia. And I would say 75% of our group have found birth parents, birth families. And because a lot of times they will give up the children simply because they can't afford to take care of them. So they have found birth families, even relatives, and made contact, and just so they can know that their children are okay. So, you know, sometimes people go international and still want to make contact so their kids have that, you know, that family background. They
right.
know where they came from.
Right.
All right.
And it's becoming more and more possible to do that. You know, the world is getting smaller and smaller. And I think even people who imagined that they really would never want to have contact with their child's birth parent see the value in it some years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, their little person asks questions. Tell me about, you know, the story about how I became your baby. You know,
mm-hmm.
Did I grow in your belly? So these are questions that you can't help but think of the birth parents. I think a lot of people reach out because they want the birth parents to know that they made a good decision,
mm-hmm.
that their child is being cared for and loved. And has opportunities because that's what these birth parents hoped for. You know, they hoped that this child was going to be adopted by someone.
Of course.
I would imagine it would be very, very, it would be an amazing experience to be able to get that information. That said, I think that folks who are looking at trying to make that contact should talk to their agencies rather than to just try to do it independently.
Oh, sure.
Because as with anything, there's a right way and a wrong way to go about it. And the last thing you want to do is jeopardize someone's, you know, life situation by, you know, announcing to them on the street, you're my child's birth mother.
Oh, no, of course not.
When,
yeah.
you know, when no one maybe even knew.
Right.
So, you know, that would be something that I wouldn't discourage people from doing, having the inquiry, but I would definitely direct it towards an agency, if your agency isn't a good fit in terms of your working relationship, call me. I'll help you find the right person or, you know, get online and look for other folks who've done this.
Okay. So one last time, Rob LaMarche, for people who are just tuning in, we started the conversation talking about the situation in Haiti. And, of course, there is a growing or renewed interest in possible adoptions from Haiti because obviously, after the earthquake, there are so many, you know, Haitian orphans. And the situation now stands, fill us in again.
Right. Well, as it stands now, the children that are leaving Haiti have already been adopted by families. There are not going to be any new adoptions initiated at this point. The focus is on caring for the children, locating surviving relatives who are in a position to care for those children, and then once that is done, reinstating an adoption program. Certainly, there are so many people involved and invested in helping to rebuild Haiti and to help protect these children. A new adoption process will evolve. For the time being, families need to do what they feel they can do to support the people of Haiti. Maybe wait a few weeks, notify some adoption agency with the Haiti program. As I mentioned, Diana Bonney, Kentucky Adoption Services, is a good friend and colleague of mine. She can't help you now, but wait a few weeks, let her know, hey, we're interested, and that way at some point when the door does open to adoptions in Haiti again, we know that we have really good families that are waiting to care for those children.
Definitely. Hey, Rob, why don't you, if you would, email me her contact information that I can post on my blog at radioornot.com. So, you know, people who are interested in getting more information anyway and you know, being ready when the time comes can have it handy.
Absolutely.
All right. Perfect. So Rob will send it to me. I'll put it on the blog at radioornot.com. Robert LaMarche, I know you got to get back to studying.
Yes, I do.
Spare time, he's becoming a lawyer. So in addition to being the director of the Florida Office of Alliance for Children, the website, again, is allforchildren.org. We will talk again soon. Thanks so much for the great work you do and for joining us tonight and letting us know what's going on.
Thank you for the opportunity, Nicole.
Okay, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye. All right, there you go. Robert LaMarche, a great guy. And, you know, it's all about the kids here, you know, and it's heartbreaking to watch those pictures. So right now, you know, especially down here in Florida, there are kids being cared for here, I guess, while their adoptive parents are finishing up what they need to do to get them. But as Rob said, these are the kids, their adoptions have already been approved. They're in progress. So I guess they're being cared for by the Archdiocese of Miami. But while they're here, you know, they need supplies. So Allison and I, like I said, brought a big bag full of stuffed animals for them. And hopefully it made some little kids smile. All right, let's do this. We'll take a break, a little musical interlude here on Radio or Not with Nicole Sandler, and come back, well, with a little political talk. In fact, well, this song might work. It's not an artist that everybody knows, though you should. It's Nick Lowe, So It Goes, Radio or Not.
Tower. Security's so tight tonight. Oh, they're ready for a tussle. Gotta keep your backstage passes, 'cause your promoter had the muscle. And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
But where it's going, no one knows.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. Tall villains at the head of our nations, worthy men from Spain and Siam. All day discussions with the Russians, but they still went ahead and beat all the plan. Now up jumped the U.S. representative. He's the one with the tight eyes. 747 for him in that condition. Flying back from a peacekeeping mission.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. And in the air there's after
it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes.
And so it goes. But where it's going, no one knows. But where it's going, no one knows. But where it's going.
Ah, Nick Lowe. You know, that's a guy who never got enough recognition. Nick Lowe, married to Carlene Carter, I believe, one of Johnny Cash and June, well, one of June Carter Cash's daughters. Just a great rock and roller. That song from a brilliant album called Pure Pop for Now People, going way back to like the 70s. So it goes. So it goes. All right, let's do this. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to interview Adam Cohen about this book, Nothing to Fear. And given what, the announcement that last night, right after the show ended, I turn on the TV and I find out that during the 2 hours we were on the air, the president announced his plans to have a 3-year freeze on domestic spending. Is he insane? Is he going just total? I mean, I thought after Scott Brown won the election in Massachusetts that Obama realized that he screwed up, that he had been going too far to the right? Ignoring the base, going against what the people who elected him wanted, and that he was going to, you know, get a bit more progressive in his policies. It seemed that way, didn't it? And then all of a sudden we get this massive right-hand turn, and President Obama is now taking advice from John McCain. I mean, John McCain, during the campaign, he was the one who said, we need a spending freeze. We need to just stop spending money. When every economist out there said, no, in a recession like this, you need to spend. You need to spend to spur the economy, to get it going. Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, said that, the stimulus wasn't big enough. That's the problem with the stimulus. Not that, you know, we were spending too much, that it wasn't enough. So, yes, I've been reading this book. And unfortunately, I had to pre-tape it. So we'll do this now. Hit the tape.
Ever in the middle of all this coming in.
And that's the wrong one. Okay. This is the audio I was going to play. I'm so happy to speak with you, especially today with the news that broke last night that President Obama is going to put in this spending freeze, a 3-year spending freeze. But we'll get to that in a moment. Let's start off with an introduction. Adam Cohen is with us. His book, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, is newly out in paperback. And Adam's an assistant editorial page editor at the New York Times, and you've been covering the presidential beat for quite a while, huh?
Yeah, I've been speaking come and go. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so many of us, when President Obama was inaugurated, were hoping for a new deal of sorts from him, and boy, we're certainly not seeing that. Can we go back in history and talk about what the mood was like, what the economic situation was like in America when FDR was inaugurated?
Sure. I mean, they're calling what we're going through now the Great Recession, but that was the Great Depression. Unemployment at 25%, the banking system completely collapsed, not even just what we saw last year, but literally every bank in the country closed down when FDR was inaugurated. The levels of poverty, you know, we can't imagine now because there was no such thing as food stamps and state welfare programs. So literally you'd walk down the streets in big cities and you'd see families sitting on the streets surrounded by their furniture and belongings. They'd been thrown out and didn't know where they were going to go. People fighting for scraps of food at the city dump. So things were really, really bad.
Yeah, and obviously we're not in that place now, but things now aren't so totally great either. Now, FDR took over from a very unpopular president, Herbert Hoover, who drove the country into the ground, as many would say. He didn't take the steps to make things better. thinking that the free market would correct itself and that people should rely on their neighbors and houses of worship for charity?
That's exactly right. He believed in the free market, and there's a reason that when all these poor people started living in, you know, shacks or, you know, under the bridges and in the parks and all that, they called them Hoovervilles, because, you know, poor people, victims of the Depression, were very angry at Hoover because they could tell that he really was not doing anything for them.
So what was Franklin Roosevelt's expertise coming into office? I know he was a very popular governor of New York, but what did, I mean, some people thought he was too inexperienced for the job, didn't they?
Absolutely. And some people thought he was a dilettante, a sort of rich guy who, you know, became governor of New York, but really didn't even deserve that. All that was said, but he actually was a very successful governor and probably the most progressive governor. He was the first governor to start a state emergency relief program, so a welfare program to help out the victims of the Depression. He was the first national voice to call for unemployment insurance. So he really was a leader, and it was a combination of that and the fact that Teddy Roosevelt had been so popular and they shared a name that made him a very obvious choice to become president.
And so when he was elected, I mean, I think, tell us about the history, what the New Deal, how that came about.
Well, you know, FDR promised the country a New Deal when he accepted the Democratic nomination at the Democratic Convention, but he never really said what the New Deal was, and it was always very vague in the details. He gave an indication that he wanted to help the victims of the Depression, wanted to help the unemployed, wanted to help farmers, but he never said how he was going to do it. There were only little hints of it. And he also had some real conservative strands in that campaign. He talked about how he wanted a balanced budget. He promised to cut federal spending by 25%. So it was always a very mixed bag. And when people were voting for a New Deal, they didn't exactly know what they were going to get.
Sort of like when we voted for hope and change and we didn't know what
very
we were going to get.
Very similar. Everyone wanted hope. I mean, who's opposed to hope?
Yeah, exactly. And change, which we're not seeing a whole lot of. Now, a lot of us did think that the president would bring some of FDR's toughness and willingness to get a diverse range of opinions to enact major change. And a lot of us progressives are disappointed. But FDR did. Tell us about his cabinet, the people he surrounded himself with.
Well, he had some real progressive voices that I don't think really necessarily have parallels in the current administration. So the heroine of the book is Frances Perkins, who was the first woman cabinet member, Secretary of Labor, for all four of FDR's terms. A real strong progressive voice. Many people think that the New Deal was as much Frances Perkins's as FDR's, because she had a lot of these ideas back in Albany and had begun trying to persuade him of them back then, about the need for public works programs, the need for federal relief programs, welfare programs for victims of the Depression, the need for unemployment insurance, Social Security. So these were her ideas, and she actually had a list of things that she wanted FDR to promise to support if she were going to join the cabinet, and he did, and virtually everything on the list was carried out. So she was really a driving force behind the New Deal. Harry Hopkins became the first federal relief administrator, the first person to hand out welfare to the states to give to the poor people, and he was a big advocate for that and for public works, and he ended up heading up the WPA, the famous, enormous New Deal government works program, and he was a tireless advocate for the very poorest people in society. And Henry Wallace, a farmer and third-generation farm journalist, fulfilled a similar role for the farmers, and farmers were probably the worst hit by the Depression. Their Depression had started in the 1920s. They stopped growing crops because it didn't pay to plant anything. They were starving on their own farms, and Henry Wallace was their advocate. So these three were the core progressives in the early years, and they had an enormous impact.
We're speaking with Adam Cohen. The book is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. The book is now out in paperback, and it's just a fascinating read, especially with what we're faced today. Now, when FDR took office, it was, you know, World War One had ended. It was a period of peace. And so there is also that difference with what President Obama is facing. But we have these tough economic challenges, and Obama seems to be going in the opposite direction. Now, does it have to do with the people that Obama has chosen to surround himself with, do you think?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I also think, you know, he's in charge of this government, so I wouldn't blame Timothy Geithner, you know, for the Wall Street policies, because Obama appointed him, Obama's keeping him in office, and Obama, you know, can tell him what to say. So I do think it ultimately comes down to Obama, who is maybe turning out to be a little bit more cautious and centrist than some of the people who voted for him expected.
Right. Well, he was also touted by the right-wing media as, quote, the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate. Now, there were those of us on the air screaming, "That in what world is that?" But unfortunately, that's what the American people were sold. They were sold a bill of goods there. But what we now have, I mean, in the news that just broke yesterday about this spending freeze that I guess we'll hear more of in the State of the Union address tomorrow, what it seems like he's doing is bringing in a lot of the ideas that John McCain had during the campaign that Obama campaigned against.
Yeah, I mean, I think progressives are disappointed on a number of fronts. One is, I would say, the whole area of Wall Street policy, right? I mean, I think Obama's turning out to be much more, supportive of Wall Street's own agenda than people expected. And we're not getting a lot of the regulatory, framework that we were promised. So I think people are unhappy about that. I would also put jobs there. I mean, FDR understood, and obviously unemployment was much higher then, but the centrality of getting people back to work. And that was, if government had to create the jobs, whatever it took, people needed to work. That was what was necessary to get families through the hard times. We're not getting that same focus on jobs, I think, yet. Maybe we'll see more of that in the State of the Union. I don't know. And then the third, as you mentioned, this new news about federal spending. And there I would say FDR was also cautious about federal spending, believed in a balanced budget. But when times were tough, he quickly abandoned that and was willing to spend to fight the hard times. So I agree with you. I see some discontent rising up among the progressive community.
Yes, you got that right.
To put it mildly, perhaps.
Yeah, to put it mildly. So what did FDR do? I mean, you mentioned the first 100 days. What was he able to accomplish in 100 days?
Well, a lot of amazing things. I mean, first, he saved the banking system in a real way. I mean, as I mentioned, every bank in the country was closed. So he got them up and running, the ones that were healthy enough to run, and he got people to feel confident about putting their money back in the banking system. And by the end of the 100 days, he got federal deposit insurance, so people knew that their money would be safe. So he did that. He did these enormous public works programs. By the end of the 100 days, there was $3.7 billion for public works. It was an enormous thing, and it made a huge difference in people's lives that so many Americans were being given government jobs who had been unemployed. For the Farm Belt, he paid farmers not to grow crops, which was necessary to prop up crop prices, which had fallen so low that it didn't pay to plant. So he saved the Farm Belt. He also did the first federal emergency relief system, so actual literal federal dollars going to the states to buy food and shelter for the poor. That was a very radical idea at the time. Some of the National Industrial Relations Act also paved the way for the first minimum wage, maximum hour, and child labor rules that the country had at the federal level. So these are major, major changes, and these have remained with us. So that and more, special government programs to help people whose farms and homes were being foreclosed. So this was really a whole lot to get done in 100 days.
Now, how different was the political climate back then? I mean, right now, as much as I fault President Obama, I put an equal amount of blame on the Congress, and especially the Republican Party, who will do anything to block any initiatives that Obama wants to get through, regardless of how good they are for the country. I take it the climate was different in Congress back then.
Very different. I mean, there were huge Democratic majorities, but also even Republicans wanted FDR to succeed. Mm-hmm. Republican members of Congress were saying, we're hearing from our constituents, give this man what he wants. You know, we need a leader, we need leadership. And so they voted for things in overwhelming numbers. We did not see this obstruction that we're seeing now. Today, a minority, and not a very large minority in the Senate, is calling the shots in everything. Somehow they've invented this rule that everything requires 60 votes, which it does not. So now you see really the tail is wagging the dog. Unless the most conservative elements of the Republican Senate minority want something, there's a very small chance of it passing.
Yes, and therein lies the problem. And unless they address this filibuster, and as you said, that's not how the Senate was designed. The Senate was designed to rule by majority, 50 plus one votes, and it passes. In fact, I'm going to do a segment, hopefully, maybe even tonight, on the filibuster and all that. But it's a massive sea change in what FDR had to deal with. So he had some bold ideas, and he was able to get them through, both because even the opposing party realized it's for the good of the country to fix things and even try things. Even FDR said, look, I'm not sure that these will work, but he, something to that effect, you correct me, that he was willing to take chances to try to make things better.
That's exactly right. And you really saw the country was acting in a very unified way. Later, certainly FDR had his critics and people attacked him. But, you know, the fact that from day one, Obama has just had, you know, the vicious attacks, you know, the teabaggers, the, you know, protesters, and then just obstructionism in Congress. I mean, it does make you feel that even if he had a more ambitious agenda, and who knows, maybe he does, it's a very hostile environment right now in Congress.
Yeah, so knowing Franklin Roosevelt as well as you do, having written the book Nothing to Fear, what advice would you give President Obama to turn things around?
Oh, I think he should be using the bully pulpit more. FDR did a great job of rallying the troops, rallying public opinion around very progressive causes. Obama could be speaking more about, you know, if he thinks the banks are misbehaving, he should be out there speaking about that. If he has some particular vision for a more progressive direction, he should talk about that. Tactical politics. I mean, I'm surprised that, you know, Obama didn't do more about that Massachusetts election, considering how much rode on it. You know, you'd have to think that the White House could have done more to keep that seat Democratic, Ted Kennedy's seat. And that may be something that really comes back to haunt the Obama administration. It's not clear to me how that got away.
No, me either. And then there are those of us who feel like, you know, for the first couple of days, he looked like he was going to head in the right direction. And then with this news of the spending freeze, he's took a complete left turn. So I guess we will find out. To be continued, right? Adam Cohen, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, now out in paperback. It is a great book and something that I hope the president will read and something that we should all read as well. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. There you go. That was Adam Cohen. And again, the book, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. This is what I thought we were getting. I thought we would have a courageous president in Barack Obama, one who would stand up and, yes, bring in some people who disagreed with him, but he would use his considerable brain power to do the right thing and figure out the right things to do. And it seems like time and time again, he's just making the wrong decisions. Oh, all right, let's do this and check the news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Joining us now from the Talk Radio News Service at talkradionews.com is my old pal and, I guess, former co-worker, Jack Rice. Hey, Jack.
I don't even know where to start with that. Do you?
we'll start with you. You landed at least a temporary gig. You're filling in for at 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on WWRL in New York. That's nice.
Yeah, you know, it was a lot of fun. I was on for 3 hours today. I love New Yorkers. The reason I love New Yorkers is because I get women calling me honey. You know, and it's usually like this. It's like, listen, honey,
uh-huh.
and it starts right there. And frankly, I love that. I love uh-huh. everything about that. I have four daughters at home. And I got a wife at home, so there are five women in my house already.
Mm.
I'm sort of already used to it. And so it's really, really fun. So I admit it. I had a great time tonight.
Well,
so,
you sound in it. You sound in a great mood, and that, you know, it's important. I mean, for those who are just tuning in and just joining us, Jack Rice and I work together at Air America Radio, and they closed the doors this past Thursday, leaving us both unemployed. I started this show immediately, just took it right online. Jack, though, is smarter because he's getting paid.
Well, you know, it's a really weird thing, isn't it? I mean, this is weird for me, and again, Nicole, in my mind, it's a hard thing for me, you know. I mean, in terms of sort of where it leaves us, it kind of leaves us very high and dry in a lot of ways. And I come home and I look at my wife and I look at the girls. I got one of my kids starting college.
Wow.
And I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with my life? And so it's been very, very hard personally, emotionally. It really has been. And yet there's one thing that I don't want to say this helps me, but it gives me at least a little perspective. I was watching the news the other night and it was about Haiti. And it was a story about this guy who was sitting on the side of the road holding a bowl. And next to him was his wife and his, like, half a dozen kids. And what happened was he heard that the government of Haiti was giving free rides to people out of the capital. You know, and so what he did is he took the last little money he had because he figured he has this ride to get out of the capital because he lost everything, his house, he's got nothing, he's done. He took the last, like, dollar that he had in his pocket, and he went and he bought food that was in this bowl for his family because they hadn't eaten in like 2 days. And he was waiting for the ride to take him out of the capital, hoping he would be better because people are starving.
Right.
And what he found was that it was only a rumor and that there was no ride. And he was sitting there on the side of the road with his wife and his kids with this empty bowl because they had eaten it all because there was nothing else. And there was his family there. And I thought to myself, what a whiny piece of crap. That I would sit here and go, oh my God, what am I going to do with my family and college, and what am I? And I mean it. I mean, I'm trying to kind of keep it in that perspective where you realize, you know what, you and I are like a whole bunch of other Americans, and you realize what some people are going through, and for me to say a word is frankly repulsive, and generally I don't say those words on the air.
Right. But you know what? It's all relative. And the thing is, we are in a really tough spot in this country with record unemployment numbers and this president who ran on hope and change and doing things differently than what we were subjected to for the previous 8 years. And here we are. And he's I'm sorry, but he's looking a whole lot like Bush Light today.
I heard you were talking about, you know, your last interview that you did with somebody looking at FDR. I have a 3-volume set I'm just starting right now. I'm not pushing this. It's not mine. I just bought it because I wanted to read it by Schlesinger.
Oh.
Kind of the famous 3-volume set
right.
Of Roosevelt from 1919 through 1936, 3-volume set. And it sort of talks about what this guy did. And what's amazing to me when I think about Obama is that, I mean, I followed this guy during the campaign. So I'm in Iowa as a reporter covering this guy. I'm in New Hampshire following this guy. I'm in the room when I think he's going to win. He loses down wherever he was in Keene or someplace in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the room. And afterward, I'm all over the place. I see this guy all over the country. And I remember what he was running on. He wasn't running to the right. He wasn't running as a quote-unquote centrist, as the GOP calls him. He was running on health care as a right.
Yeah, basic human right. Yep.
Yeah, he was running on the middle class being the focus rather than an afterthought. And all of a sudden, it's like he's bought into this weird Democratic concept. I mean that as a party Democratic concept, which sometimes to me I see as this idea that what they really want is people to love them.
Yeah.
I don't give a damn about the Democratic Party winning or losing. I'm a liberal. I'm not a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. No.
And what I'm angry about is that I know what this guy ran on. I saw his record. I've seen him speak lots of times, and I know what I was expecting. And to make the argument that somehow now he's coming back to who he was, well, then he's coming back to something that he didn't run on. And that is the lie, if that's where we are going. And that is not something I'm just saying personally, although that's something I believe personally. It's something I am hearing over and over again across the country.
It is frightening. Now, and the latest, I mean, after the Scott Brown win, I thought, all right, maybe this is what he needed to shake him back into reality and to return to the guy we saw on the campaign trail. The guy who, you know, the fierce urgency of now, change, hope, we're going to make, you know, turn it around. And I'm thinking, New Deal coming, another FDR on the way. And so when Scott Brown won, I thought, all right, so now he's gonna regroup and come back and do things the right way, and it's not too late to salvage this presidency and the country. And then yesterday we find out he wants to institute a 3-year domestic spending freeze. I mean, why not? How about a military freeze? How about pull back all those damn troops and bring them home and spend the money here where it's needed?
The estimate is $1 million a soldier.
Yeah.
When I was in Afghanistan right before Christmas, and yep. I was talking to teachers in Afghanistan. I could educate between 25 and 40,000 girls in Afghanistan. Between 25 and 40,000 girls for the price of one soldier.
Yeah.
And now we have decided that the best way to deal with Afghanistan is spending that times 30 just for the soldiers. I don't know if you saw this. It was a New York Times
just for the so-called surge.
Eikenberry. And Eikenberry is the U.S. ambassador,
right.
But he was the former military commander in Afghanistan, and he's the one who came out and said sending more troops in Afghanistan will make things worse, because in fact it will give Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, another excuse to not step up and to lean even more on the Americans. Imagine what would happen if we had taken that money that we're spending on troops and soldiers and Hellfire missiles and tanks to go in and kill bad guys, if we had actually came in and gave the people of Afghanistan a reason to survive. But we're not doing that.
No.
Oh, no, we wouldn't want to do that. That would be a disaster, right? Because I guess that would make us socialist or something.
And so now he's screaming, okay, we got to do something about the deficit. When you got people like Paul Krugman saying, yeah, the deficit is bad and everything, but when we're in a steep recession, especially, this is the worst recession since the Great Depression, this is not the time to pinch pennies. This is when you got to spend. So who's he listening to here?
That's especially true when you hear this from the GOP, all of a sudden terribly concerned about fiscal responsibility President Bush spent more money than any presidency all the way back to LBJ. That's what the Cato Institute says. That's not me. That's Cato.
Yeah.
And Cato Institute.
Cato ain't no liberal group.
Yeah, trust me. These guys aren't there to prop up lefties like me. And they're making the argument, and I don't recall one Republican all of a sudden stepping up. But now, all of a sudden, trust me, there is nothing that this president could do. I mean, remember, Obama's the president who is trying to take your guns away, and he's actually given more rights for Second Amendment. He's given people who want to carry guns more capability to do that than any president in recent memory. And yet, this is the guy. Trust me, the GOP isn't about trying to support this president. And yet, this guy is what, listening to them, pandering to them.
Yeah, and
they
still, even when he talked about his, his reaction to the Supreme Court gutting democracy last Thursday and everything else, he's still going off on this bipartisan support. Get over it already, Obama. No matter, even though you are now doing your damnedest to pander to them by putting in all of John McCain's campaign ideas, and as far as I remember, we didn't vote for John McCain, they still will not support you. I guess he just wants to lose. He wants the Congress to lose, the Democrats to lose seats in both houses of Congress come November, and he wants to lose the presidency in 2012. And what blows my mind is, I don't know if you heard this exchange with Diane Sawyer on the interview he did with her today, but listen to this.
Ever in the middle of all this coming at you, think maybe one term is enough?
You know, I would say that the one thing I'm clear about is that I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president. And I believe that. There's a tendency in Washington to think that our job description of elected officials is to get reelected. That's not our job description. Our job description is to solve problems and to help people. And you know, that's not just the view of elected officials themselves. That's also the filter through which the media reads things. Maybe the reason I can say this with confidence is I've gone through this before. I went through this through the campaign. When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached. If my poll numbers are high, boy, he's calm and reasoned, right? So that's the filter through which a lot of this stuff is interpreted.
So Jack Rice, jackrice.org, by the way, is Jack's website, and he's with us tonight representing the Talk Radio News Service, thetalkradionews.com. You know, he says one thing, but his actions show something totally different. And now he's listening to, I don't know if it's Rahm whispering in his ear, saying, you got to move more to the right, more to the right, more to the right. The rest of us are just sitting here scratching our heads going, you know, I can say this because I'm online now and not on the radio anywhere. What the fuck?
I'm so not used to hearing you say that. It kind of freaks
I'm
me
so
out.
I'm so not used to saying it into a microphone either. That's weird. But
yeah,
but I can.
Like, oh, gee.
It's like, <"Ugh!" laughs>
you know, it's a very weird thing for me when I listen to this president say things like this, because as I think about it, what it feels like is he's made this decision that what the GOP is saying is correct, okay? Because that's what it sounds like to me. He's decided that what they're saying is correct. And the problem that I have with that belief is that if you look at where we are and why we are where we are, it's based upon philosophical concepts that are bedrocked in the GOP.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what deregulation is about from beginning to end. The reason that you would freeze spending, the reason you would gut infrastructure is because the GOP concept, and I'm not even going to sugarcoat this, left or right, the GOP concept is starve everything, be as selfish as you can be, give everybody back their own money, let the entire country collapse on itself, and somehow people will do better that way. But the problem with that idea is we have just seen exactly what that is. When you deregulate everything, what you get are people who are willing to bet everything and then some, and they did, and it's brought the entire system down in a crashing halt, and yet this president seems to be accepting that there's something to that basic premise because he hasn't stepped up. Where's the regulation we have seen? Nowhere.
Nowhere.
Where is the approach that says we're going to tax in such a way that we can rebuild our infrastructure? It's nowhere. Where is it where we're going to step up and provide the rights that the American people need so there's an infrastructure in place so people can actually make a living? There is none.
Nope.
We haven't seen any of these things, and the longer we do this, the more this guy is sort of the new boss. It sounds like the old boss.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so discouraging. So tomorrow night is the State of the Union. I'm almost afraid to watch. I am. I'm actually going to, you know, my show is on radioornot.com. We're live from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern. The State of the Union starts tomorrow night at 9. I may take a little break and then come back for a special edition, and we'll have a viewing party where we can all be snarky and just look on and listen in disbelief, because I'm petrified of what I'm going to hear.
Oh, I'm so excited. Are you joking? I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm going to be in the bowels of the Capitol,
oh my God.
I intend to pound on people. You know, I mean, I intend to be there. One of my favorite, two of my favorite public officials. One of them is Dennis Kucinich.
Mm-hmm.
I love some Dennis, too. Okay, I love me some Dennis. That sounds a little odd, but you know what? I'm good with it. I'm loving me some Dennis.
Good.
Says, I love me some Russ Feingold. I love
uh-huh.
me some Russ.
Uh-huh. And Bernie Sanders.
You know, and Bernie Sanders. Those are my three guys.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Now, amongst others, there's several others too. And what I want is I'm going to go for some answers to some of my guys. And I'm going to go to my guys and say, okay, at what point do you want to shoot this man out of a cannon?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and I mean that, you know, not literally, obviously.
I know.
But, I mean,
you know, I want...
Do you want that?
I want one of those three to primary him. Now, of course, they can't do anything until after the November elections. I mean, Dennis Kucinich has to run for his congressional seat again. And he's been targeted by the DLCers. The Democratic Party does not like Dennis Kucinich because he doesn't do what Nancy Pelosi tells him to do. He votes with his conscience. He does what he thinks is right, what for his constituents and for the country. So he's got to...
All I know is I remember being in New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
and I had a long conversation with Dennis, with Congressman Kucinich and his wife, who I think is amazing in her own right. And I had a long conversation with one guy who strongly supported Dennis Kucinich, Viggo Mortensen. You remember he was a guy
oh, yeah.
who was
in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, he was Lord of the Rings guy, uh-huh. but he's the one who did, Eastern Promises.
Okay.
You remember, this was a story where he played this kind of like undercover, guy who was trying to get into the Russian mafia, and he got in this like huge knife fight, totally naked, right? It's an amazing. You got to go see this thing. It's awesome.
Okay,
it's awesome.
Okay.
But the thing is I love Viggo Mortensen because Viggo Mortensen was making a ton of money at the uh-huh. time, basically stopped doing everything so he could go on the road with Dennis Kucinich.
Uh-huh.
And so I sat down for this really long conversation with Viggo.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, anybody named Viggo, I'm all for anyway, just because
yeah.
I think it's a cool
right.
name.
Yeah.
But all I know is I looked at what it is that Dennis Kucinich stands for, and to me, what he says is exactly what I hear from everybody who's running for office as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I hear them running on.
Right.
They run on Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah.
And then they run on Dennis, and they rule on McCain.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I never got it. And yet look at all these sort of kind of wafty, ridiculous Democrats who line up saying, oh, we're all for these things. And then they denigrate the Republicans. Hell, at least the Republicans are intellectually honest and that they know they're full of crap. And they'll say it basically to your face. And then they'll come back and do what they do. At least they're honest about it. I'm not even getting that from the Dems anymore.
No. I'm not either. And for Obama to say that to Diane Sawyer, that, you know, it's not their job to run for re-election. It's their job to, you know, be the best president, do the best job they can do in office. And here I go again. Bullshit. You know, that's
sorry,
what it sorry. Should be. But that's not what they're doing. I know that's the beautiful thing about not being controlled by the FCC. You can say whatever you want. And you know, it's blowing my mind what Obama is doing here. And it's frightening. And so Dennis Kucinich, I did ask him, in an interview not too long ago if he would consider another run in 2012. And of course, I wasn't even thinking about 2010, and he's got to get reelected first. So that's his first thing. So, but I'll tell you, if Obama continues down this course, he will be primaried in 2012. And I hope it's by a Kucinich but here's the problem with Kucinich or with the Bernie Sanders. We are in reality show age. And, you know, look at Scott Brown. I think he won because of how he looks. I think Sarah Palin was chosen because she's straight out of Central Casting. She looked the part. Okay. Barack Obama and his family, good looking people. I really think somebody who looks, and I'm not saying this to be mean or anything, I'm just talking the truth. Somebody who looks like a Dennis Kucinich or a Bernie Sanders is going to have a really hard time getting elected in the age of video.
Well, everybody is starting to look back at John Edwards.
Yeah.
And taking a closer look at sort of what it was that he did and some of the things he may have been doing on the trail. And it kills me because the fact that he was as pro-union and standing up for workers. And I heard good things out of him, but you know, after the fact, I mean, who knows what's
well,
true and what's
false. And you know what? I hate to say it. I voted for John Edwards in the Florida primary because I thought he stood. I liked what he said. He did say he said the right things, and I thought he stood the best chance of getting elected. Right.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm with you. And I mean, that's the rough part. I'm telling you. I mean, you and I are going to have these conversations again, I suspect, aren't we?
Oh, I think a lot, unfortunately. Jack Rice is with us. His website is jackrice.org. So you're going to be out there tomorrow. Maybe I can talk you into calling in after the speech, because I'll be on late tomorrow night.
Yeah, we'll figure. I mean, I will find a way. I'm going to be getting a lot of interviews myself, so I'll be shooting a lot of video and other things. And maybe
gotcha.
I can shoot some of those to you too. So you
that'd be awesome.
Post those on your website as well. So if you like that, and I'm happy to do that for your listeners, because you have some pretty rabid fans. I'm aware of that.
I would love that. All right. Well, Jack Rice, I know you had a long day. You will be again tomorrow on the air at WWRL, which streams live out of New York from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern. We'll survive.
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, when you talk to those people over there, ask them if they need someone from, 6 to 8 p.m.
Amen, sister. I trust me. If I'm thinking anybody, I'm thinking of you.
Jack Rice, you're the best. I'll talk to you. We'll talk soon.
Sounds great.
All right. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. All right. We didn't really get the news update from Jack, but that was more fun anyway. Oh, yes. It is Nicole Sandler here. RadioOrNot.com is the website. We'll take a break and come back on the other side with the one and only Howie Klein of DownWithTyranny.com. And, I've played this song, not in its entirety, but I've threatened to use it as a second theme song. Listen to the words. It's Thunderclap Newman. Something in the air. Yeah, we've got to get it together now. It's Radio or Not. We'll be right back.
And you
Thunderclap Newman. Ah, there's something in the air. Yes, we've got to get it together. a peaceful revolution would be really nice. All right. We are calling Howie Klein now. Again, this is the way I have to do it without a producer.
Howie here.
Hey, Howie, it's Nicole Sandler.
Hi, Nicole. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good, too. Thanks.
Good. We are live on the new show on RadioOrNot.com. Lots of people watching on Ustream and listening via the Internet. And thank you for joining me on the first week back.
Great. Well, my pleasure. And Nicole, when you say we are live, that means we're live now. You're not the first, like the screener?
No, we are live. I don't have a screener. I don't have a producer. I don't have anyone making the calls. So I had to call you and put you on live on the air.
Cool.
Yeah, because I was playing a song, but I've got one. I get a better setup here because I have one audio, a pot is what it's called, that all the audio from the computer goes through. So when I bring you up on the phone through the computer, that would have gone over the air.
I have a song that I'm playing around with for my post that goes up in about an hour and a half, and it's an absolutely wonderful song that probably, well, some of your younger listeners probably know well. It's by a band from Orange County called Blink 182.
Yeah.
And they just, like, absolutely got it right, even though they weren't trying, about Obama.
Which song?
And, the song is called Man Overboard, but that doesn't tell you anything.
Okay.
But, there's so much more than I wanted, and there's so much more than I needed. And time just keeps moving on and on and on. Soon we'll all be gone. Let's take some time to talk this over. When you're out of line and rarely sober, we can't depend on your excuses, because in the end, it's blank, 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 useless. Anyway, I don't do it quite as well as they do,
right.
but it's one of their big, huge hit songs. I don't know if you have it there or not in the library.
I can pull it up, and maybe I'll play it, to go out. See, that's the beautiful thing. You know, as much as it pains me to have lost Air America, being just on the Internet is really freeing, because I'm playing music. I can curse if I want. I mean, if I'm really angry.
Oh, great.
And
I shouldn't have said blank, blank. But you don't have to. Fucking.
Exactly. You don't have to say blank, blank on the Internet.
Okay.
Now, when we get back on another station, we'll have to be careful again. But, that's, the beautiful thing about it. So, yeah, I'm looking for the silver lining.
Here in L.A., Air America was so terrible. I mean, it was excruciatingly bad. When in the time slot that you were when I used to go on with you at night, they had some literally a right winger on, like just putting down progressives, and he would do it under the guise as though he were a progressive, but he was just on there to put down progressives.
Oh, Phil Hendry,
annoying
show. Yeah, it's Phil Hendry, and the station in L.A. never carried my show anyway. I mean, it was a network that was a syndicator that offered a lot of programs, but it was up to the individuals. Stations to decide what shows they wanted to carry. And Phil Hendry is like that. He says he's a liberal because I think he wants to get on the progressive talk stations, but he's not.
I just couldn't bear listening to that station anymore because of him and a couple of other really terrible, terrible shows they put on. Then they'd have all these shows about diarrhea medicine all weekend,
on the weekends,
and then sports all the time. I mean, it was just. It's like they did everything they could to kill progressive radio.
Yes, and that's the problem. And I really think that the future of it is probably going to be online because the media, contrary to what Fox will tell you, the media is controlled by big corporations, and big corporations are historically Republicans and even more so now. But that's why you have 9 hours of what they call conservative talk. I call right wing, windbags like Rush Limbaugh, 9 hours to every 1 hour of progressive talk. You can go through state after state after state driving across the country without hearing a progressive voice on the radio, but you cannot go through one city in this country without finding Rush Limbaugh on at least one station. you know?
Oh, well.
So I think
And when you say you can go through state after state, that includes states like California.
Yeah, and Florida.
There's a huge swath of California where they don't hear progressive talk.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I think if we are going to make any inroads, it will be online. And, you know, we just have to hope that the timing is right. I mean, you and I told the story the other day how I'd been through this before. Back in 2000, in Los Angeles, when Channel 103.1 was sold because of consolidation, I convinced the Clear Channel owners to move us online. We became the first radio station in the country to go from a terrestrial only signal and over the air signal to internet only seamlessly when the station was sold. And so the, we did that. And unfortunately we were too early, you know, then the dot-com boom bust happened and I was out of a job again, but now it's 10 years later and hopefully, the time is right. I mean, I posted a story yesterday about this new Blaupunkt in dash Wi-Fi internet car radio that they showed at the Consumer Electronics Show last a couple of weeks ago, so it's coming.
Great.
Yeah. So
how would that work?
There's like a it takes the feed from your cell phone. So if you have, like, for instance, you can listen on an iPhone. You can listen to streaming audio. It takes the feed. It actually picks it up from your smartphone. You have to have like an iPhone plan. I, for instance, have an Android. I've got the G1 phone, which I've got the, you know, the internet plan, and it can pull it in and somehow it feeds it to the car stereo.
Ooh.
So if you can get a, you know, a G3 or a 3G signal on your phone, you can pick it up in your car. So this is coming. We are just about here. And then they won't be able to limit what you can hear on your radio. But as we learned on Thursday, the same day Air America got killed, these big corporations will be able to do pretty much anything else they want in terms of buying elections.
Yep. In fact, That's something that I was just sort of writing up right now because I got a really sort of fatuous email today. You probably did as well, from Bob Menendez, the chairman of the DSCC, which is charged with reelecting Democrats to the Senate.
Right.
And he's asking for money and he's crying about this terrible decision of the Supreme Court. Well, you know, one of the people who's going to get the most, if you donate a dollar to them, The biggest portion of that will go to help the fruitless effort, and that's impossible to reelect Blanche Lincoln. That's where your money's going to go, down to Arkansas to reelect Blanche Lincoln, who happens to have been instrumental in Sam Alito being confirmed.
Wow.
Now, you know, and just today, Blanche Lincoln did two other, like, really hideous things. One, she said she will vote and she will be against reconciliation in the Senate for health care reform.
I saw that.
And she was demanding that Obama terrorist suspects in military tribunals, not in the U.S. justice system. She joined with a bunch of Republicans in making that demand. She's also the only Democrat to have said that she will join the Republican filibuster against employee free choice, which in effect killed that legislation for this year. So he wants us to support, he wants to use the Supreme Court decision to get us to give money to support the person who was partially responsible for that decision, Blanche Lincoln.
Unbelievable. And that's why you want to go give your money to a group like the Blue America PAC that Howie Klein at DownWithTyranny.com runs with John Amato of Crooks and Liars and Digby of Hullabaloo, because they are funneling the money directly to the real progressive candidates. Screw the DLC people. And
in the case of Arkansas, we actually have a page dedicated just to defeating Blanche Lincoln. I mean, when people are like have their jaws dropping and they can't believe that her approval ratings are so low and they won't go above 45%, and in many polls they're way below 45%. It's by the way, there has never in the history of of polling been a senator this close to the election numbers like hers who has been reelected. It's never happened. Any senator with the kind of polling numbers that she has, every single one of them from either party has been defeated. So she will be defeated, and people wonder, how did that happen? And I have to say, we've had ads up in Arkansas, very, very targeted ads up in Arkansas since June.
Now, Howie, didn't I read something at Down with Tyranny that there was at least a rumor that she maybe was going to pull out Blanche Lincoln?
Yeah. Well, I tweeted it. I said that it would never happen.
Oh.
She called, like, you know, she wanted to make a big display about all the huge amounts of money that she's raised, you know, which is just embarrassing. She gets money basically from agricultural interests, from the insurance companies, from the medical industrial complex, you know, and from the big banks. She gets that money for selling out the interests of ordinary Americans and embracing the interests of corporate America. So she was bragging that she raised all this money. So in order to get some excitement going, she tweeted that she has a big announcement tomorrow, meaning today. And you know, there was so a rumor started that her big announcement was going to be that she was going to step down and let the Lieutenant Governor Halter run as the Democrat, the way Dodd stepped down and allowed the Attorney General of Connecticut to run for Senate, thereby saving the Connecticut Senate seat. Now, if she steps down, there's a chance that the Democrats can keep that Democratic seat in Arkansas, but that, I knew that wasn't going to happen, and nor did it happen, nor will it happen.
Mm.
Although supposedly there are some people in the administration that are trying to persuade her to you know, go off to some, you know, very highly paid corporate job.
Yeah, go join Chris Dodd somewhere
and Walter Run or Wes Clark. He'd be another.
He'd
another
be great. No, send Blanche Lincoln off to join Chris Dodd somewhere.
Or one of the lobbying firms that she's so close with.
No kidding. No kidding. Howie Klein is with us from downwithtyranny.com. So you have a piece up on the blog. The villagers ask themselves, who killed health care reform, and happily point at progressives. What the hell's going on with health care reform? Scott Brown gets elected and they cave?
It looks that way. It looks like they're relieved that they don't have to go through this whole process, and they can just. I mean, this is just an absolute catastrophe for every. I mean, they'll probably pass some kind of lame thing or get a few things done, but they were looking for an excuse. They found the excuse. It was the disaster that they brought on themselves in Massachusetts, and they don't need to cave. But they
still have 59 seats. Right.
It's beyond belief.
Yeah, like the Republicans rule the Senate 41-59. How absurd is this?
It's completely absurd. I mean, Bush never had any kind of majority like that ever. And yet he got through tons of things that are very, very controversial, that was certainly not nearly as popular as good health care reform is. And he didn't hesitate, but you know, we don't seem to have much of a leader in Obama. I mean, you know, it really sort of scares me. You know, I certainly voted for the guy. My PAC never raised a cent for him because I didn't have a lot of confidence that he would be FDR, to put it mildly. The people who were looking for an FDR, I knew that wasn't going to happen. He had a terrible voting record in the brief time he was in the Senate. He was always sort of tucked in between Joe Lieberman and Max Baucus. I mean, they always had a really bad voting record.
But,
so I had, I looked at that and I said, well, this guy's not going to be a great president. You know, on the other hand, he was, you know, he's important as a symbolic president.
Yeah, you know what, Howie, you had the faux noise machine claiming that Barack Obama was the most liberal member of the U.S. Senate. And they say things enough times and people believe them.
I think at that time when they were making that claim, he was the 53rd most liberal member.
We shouldn't laugh, I mean, because it's really sad. And now we have a guy who, after the loss in Massachusetts, I thought that, all right, now he's going to regroup. He'll realize that by screwing his base, he's basically screwing the country, and he's going to turn around, and he can still turn this presidency around. Look, JFK had a lousy first year too. He can turn it around and make things better, and he'll come to his senses. And then he goes last night and says, we're going to have a 3-year domestic spending freeze. What world do we live in? Wasn't it John McCain who was campaigning on that?
And not only was John McCain campaigning on it, but Obama, three times in three public debates, said, you know, made fun of John McCain for it and refuted John McCain's ideas about a spending freeze. You know, you mentioned JFK. He had some pretty decent advisors. Not that all of them were so wonderful, but there were plenty that were. Obama, you know, his first pick was Rahm Emanuel. You're not going to get worse than that. So he already found the worst possible person to bring in as his chief of staff, you know, the sort of the Tom DeLay of the Democratic Party. And then his economic, his main economic guy is Larry Summers, who is as bad in economics as Rahm Emanuel is in politics. And, you know, the nicest thing anybody can say about Tim Geithner is that he's just a robotic, you know, nothing. I mean, that's the nicest thing that anyone can say about him. I mean, he's got a really terrible crew around him, which is why my expectations for this guy are just dismal at this point. I'm just trying to do everything I can to not dwell on him and to think about some of the great progressives that we have in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, people like Bernie Sanders, people mm-hmm. like Jeff Merkley in the Senate. You know, we have
Russ Feingold,
awesome House members.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Bon Amato and I spent part of Sunday afternoon with the congressman from Portland, Oregon. There's my memory going.
People in the I'm drawing on it too. Ron Wyden.
No, that's nope. The senator.
Oh, DeFazio
from Oregon.
Peter DeFazio Peter DeFazio.
Sorry.
Peter DeFazio.
No, it's not DeFazio.
Nope, not
I'm
DeFazio.
Sorry. I'll walk over to
it,
to where I've been writing about it and look it up. But anyway, the guy is just, you know, absolutely wonderful. Talking about, you know, we sat down and he just started talking about sustainability and livability and all these things that really, really impact people's lives. And I'd so much rather focus on people like that, work as best as I can to help people like that, and not the guy I'm sorry thinking about, by the way, is Earl Blumenauer.
Oh, Earl Blumenauer. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
A great progressive. So it's what we're doing at Blue America is trying to focus on both incumbents like him, like Alan Grayson, like Donna Edwards, and challengers from all over the country who are going up against reactionaries. So whether those are Republican reactionaries or they are Democratic reactionaries, i.e. Blue Dogs, that's where we're doing our work. There's nothing much we can do about Obama. He is what he is. And we're stuck with him. Chances are he's going to, you know, I hate to say this because what will come will be much worse, but chances are he's going to be a one-term president. I think he's already embracing the idea of being a one-term president. He keeps talking about it.
Yeah, but here's the problem. So if he knows he's going to be a one-term president, then make the bold moves and do the things that we who voted for him to do. Instead, he's turning Republican and realizing that he's only going to be a one-term president. What good does that do us? He's going to drive us further into the hole that George Bush dug for him.
But that's the thing is that's where he always was. That is, he's always been, you know, sort of in the mushy middle. That's what he was his whole career. I mean, so you can't suddenly expect someone who's been sort of just voting along with Joe Lieberman to suddenly turn into, you know, a Jeff Merkley or a Sherrod Brown. He never voted anywhere near them. He was much, much closer to, you know, Arlen Specter in his voting patterns and Olympia Snow and Ben Nelson. I mean, that's where he was on the political spectrum.
Yep. I know. Howie Klein is with us from downwithtyranny.com. Now, I mentioned the Blue America PAC that you run along with John Amato of Crooks and Liars and Digby from Hullabaloo. In the chat room, I'm going out over Ustream, and there's a chat room in there, And Bill is on in the chat from PDA, California. And there are, again, we got to band together with the progressive organizations. There's Progressive Democrats of America. There's the PCCC, which is boldprogressives.org. The Progressive Change Campaign Coalition. What I'm saying is we should not give our money to the DCCC or the DSCC, which are the Democratic Party organizations, because they are supporting the Blue Dogs. They are supporting, you know, the Jane Harmons and the Mary Landrews and the Blanche Lincolns. We need to get those people out of there so we can have, you know, we may not be able to help anything at the top, but we should be able to make some changes within the body of both houses of Congress. And then perhaps when after we get through the midterms in November, maybe we can draft one of these good, real progressives to primary Obama, because I will not work for him. I will not vote for him.
Well, for one thing, you know, I don't know if this is supposed to be a secret or not, but Dennis Kucinich says that if no one else does it, he will primary Obama.
Well, I hope so. But, you know, the last time I asked Dennis that, his response was what it should have been, which is actually that he needs to he's got to win re-election in November 2010 first, because in the House, they have to run every 2 years. And he's always targeted, and the Democratic Party never supports him because he doesn't toe the party line. I love Dennis Kucinich. And I'll tell you, if he'd run this time, man, oh, man, I know a lot of people who would work their asses off for him.
Well, I don't know that he's going to. I don't know that Howard Dean is going to, and I don't know that anyone specific who will, but I suspect that someone will. And as far as Dennis goes, like every member of Congress, he's always, you know, thinking that he's that it's going to be hard for him to win re-election, but the fact of the matter is he's in a not a super Democratic district. But it's a safe enough Democratic district that he wins by very, very large margins every time he runs. And he, although he is targeted, he usually gets, you know, close to 60% of the vote, which is pretty significant. I know last time he beat his opponent by like over 50,000 votes, which is
and there was a lot of money going up against him. They were coming at him hard.
Right, but he doesn't really have there are a lot of people who have like much more difficult races, like right there in Ohio in Columbus, Mary Jo Kilroy, who won by the skin of her teeth. She's really being targeted. You know, Dennis is in Cuyahoga County, like, you know, the Cleveland area. They're not gonna beat him there, but she's very, very beatable, and the Republicans are targeting her in a big way. She's very progressive. She's not quite as progressive as him, but few people are.
That's true.
Mary Jo Kilroy.
Okay, well, that's another name to keep in mind. Again, this is one of the things I love about Howie Klein, is you know what's going on in all these congressional races around the country, and as we get closer, I mean, this is where the revolution starts. It's with us banding together to really get behind the progressive candidates. And you know, we talked about last week that, you know, I interviewed from New York, Jonathan Tessini, who is running for the U.S. Senate for Kirsten Gillibrand's seat. And he's a non-entity as far as anyone's concerned. They're talking about, oh, if Harold Ford runs, at least there will be a primary. Well, there are other people in the race.
Well, Harold Ford, Harold Ford was recruited by Wall Street, the same Wall Street that recruited Rahm Emanuel. I mean, when Rahm Emanuel left working for Clinton in the White House, where he was, you know, a corporate shill, you know, he's the one that twisted arms and broke ankles to get NAFTA through for the Clinton administration. And then he was recruited by Wall Street and went to work there and wound up, you know, working there for, I think he worked there for a year and a half and left with $20 million. In other words, that's what they did. They funneled a huge amount of money to someone who was never going to have to worry about finances again, and he's their guy. He's their boy. And they just did the same thing with Harold Ford. They recruited him. They gave it, he's the vice chairman of Bank America. I mean, neither of these guys is competent to do a job like that, but it was just a way for Wall Street to funnel immense sums of money, millions and millions and millions of dollars into these guys, so they would own them. And the hope was that they would get Rahm Emanuel into a position somehow, either, you know, as a senator or as the Speaker of the House or something, and instead he turns out to be running the White House, which isn't bad. And so their investment paid off. And now they're trying to do the same thing with Harold Ford, where they've given him, you know, all the money in the world, and now they're putting the Wall Street firms are his only constituency, and they're trying to get him into the U.S. Senate, which is a joke. I mean, you know, for him to be running in a state like New York is really pretty funny. He by the way, he changed his voter registration from Memphis, Tennessee,
right,
to New York City 15 days ago.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah, see, the thing is, the people of New York are just way too smart for that. But what gets me is Jonathan Tessini, and we talked about this. He's not the most animated guy. He's not the most exciting candidate, but he's a real progressive.
Unless you define exciting by ideas, then he is the most exciting.
Absolutely.
Candidate.
Absolutely. And he's, you know, he's approachable. He's on Facebook. He's out there, and he does have great ideas. And the thing is, if you listen to the media, even the so-called liberal media, MSNBC, they don't even acknowledge his existence.
Right. Well, he, of course, hasn't been able to raise any money. He ran against Hillary Clinton and didn't impress. And, you know, people are, you're right. I mean, the liberal media isn't backing him either, especially now, because even people who sort of were not very enthusiastic about Gillibrand, based on her House career, although her Senate career has been very, very good, her very short Senate career has been excellent, her House career wasn't quite as good. And people that, you know, sort of looking askance at her, now they feel that they've got to come around to supporting her because of fear of Harold Ford.
So again, we're stuck with, you know, the lesser of two evils, you know, and that's not what it should be. Somebody in the chat room just brought up again Marcy Winograd, who I did have on the show last week, and she's awesome. Did you hear?
She's Blue America's first candidate for the first challenger that we endorsed for 2010. I mean, right now I'm working on a big live musical event for her that we're going to do in Redondo Beach, that's going to be a real special kind of fundraiser, very, very different from the kinds of fundraisers that the Blue Dogs do, where their idea of a fundraiser is you go into one of these big, sleek office buildings on K Street of a lobbyist firm, and all the lobbyists in Washington come there with big, giant checks. That's their big bundles of checks, in fact. And that's their idea of a fundraiser. We're going to do something much different, where we're going to try to have some, you know, rock and roll and various alternative ways of encouraging just regular grassroots people to donate some money so that Marcy can run a competitive campaign with Jane Harman.
Well, that will be great. I mean, someone sent me a link to, I guess it was a Glenn Beck rant about the letter that I think Progressive Democrats of America sent to...
And California Progressive Caucus.
Okay, exactly. All sent out to
Lynn Woolsey,
who's the co-chair of the House Progressive Caucus, for endorsing Jane Harman and headlining this fundraiser for her. I mean, progressive. It's the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and she's out there endorsing the Blue Dog against the progressive candidate. It's infuriating.
And not only is it, do we have the vice chair of the Progressive Caucus doing something like that, but Lynn Woolsey, if there's one thing that she's known for, it's her very, very principled stand against these Bush wars that happened. I mean, she has been just really, really, really right on. She's been one of the 10 best members of Congress on these wars. Well, guess who's been the worst?
Jane Harman.
You can't find someone worse
than
Jane Harman on all of these war and torture issues. She's been just terrible. So how bizarre this is that she should be doing that. Of course, we were very, very happy at Blue America because when Glenn Beck was ranting and raving and screaming about this, he singled out John Amato.
Right, of Crooks and Liars.
For running a big piece on Crooks and Liars.
That's right. Right. So, again, and there's a link to the Blue America Pack from downwithtyranny.com, from crooksandliars.com, and from Digby's Hullabaloo. What is the website, the URL for Hullabaloo?
Well,
is it Digby's blog?
It's digby.blogspot.com.
Okay. .com. Yeah. Digby.blogspot.com. That's, I have it bookmarked, and I, yeah. So, but the Blue America Pack is there.
It's digbysblog.blogspot.com.
Okay.
So that's how it goes. Digby's with an S, blog.blogspot.com.
Okay. And those are three must-read blogs anyway. Howie Klein, it is always a pleasure talking to you. Keep us posted on the benefit for Marcy Winograd. Do you know when that's going to be?
Well, it's in the planning stages right now, but we're looking for it to be the 1st of April.
Oh, okay. All right.
So it would be like a Don't Be Fooled Again kind of concert.
Awesome. I like that. Howie Klein, downwithtyranny.com, a regular guest, and I thank you for staying with us in this big move to radioornot.com.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. You know what? You mentioned the Blink 182 song, Man Overboard. Tell us again. This is, and I don't know this song, but I'm going to play it because
I love this song. I just love it, love it, love it. I have it going up on my blog at 6 o'clock, and you're going to play it now. It's such an awesome song. Let me stay on while you play it.
Okay. I'm going to play it right now, and then we'll do a wrap-up. But you said this perfectly explains the situation with Obama?
In my mind, it absolutely goes right to what Obama is right in the middle of doing right now and how progressives feel about him.
Okay, it is Blink 182, Man Overboard, Radio or Not. Blink 182, Man Overboard. And Howie Klein, I get why you said that. It is
good.
Certainly apropos. Yeah. All right, Howie. Well, tomorrow night is the State of the Union address. Any predictions?
Oh, I predict it'll be as awful as we all feel it'll be.
Ugh,
So anyone who's hoping, you know, that it won't be as bad as it looks, forget it.
Yeah, I'm dreading it. We're going to do, the show is now on live 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm going to then take a little break tomorrow night and come back on live. That's the other beautiful thing about the internet. I could flip it on and do it when I want. We'll come back on and be on live during the speech so we can sort of do live rebuttals as they're warranted.
Ooh.
Anyway, Howie Klein, downwithtyranny.com is the website. Thanks again, Howie. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, and that's going to do it for us for tonight. Please check out radioornot.com. Heather, my amazing webmaster, put on a forum, so there is a message board there. It's ready to go, so post away. And join us back here tomorrow night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern. And again, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern for the State of the Union. Oh, boy. All right. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thanks for listening. Radio or not. Bye.